Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining the conference call here. This is John Bagwell, and we've got two other Johns from Enough on the line as well, John Norris, the executive director, and John Prendergast, co-founder of the organization as well. And I wanted to just open up and say that we wanted this call to happen because there's been a lot going on recently, some controversy surrounding General Gratian, the special envoy's statements in the past week or week and a half here, as well as the CPA conference that was held earlier this week. And we wanted to use this opportunity with a lot of news coming out to update all of you on the policy, where we go from here, our perspective on all of this stuff, and also allow you a chance to ask some questions of John Norris and John Prendergast. So I'm going to turn it over to them. They'll each talk for 5 to 10 minutes to kind of set the stage, and then we will open it up for questions, and the operator will assist us in that and let us know how you can ask questions when the time is right. But John, I will turn it over to the two of you.
So this is John Norris, and thanks, John. And I'm assuming all 60 people on the call are also named John, that we have some kind of convention going. We, both John and I, want to keep our statements fairly short, that we want to field your questions and want to have it more of a discussion than a one-way conversation. It has been a busy couple weeks. I, like everybody else probably on this call, I must say I am pretty concerned by General Gratian's recent comments. I think his initial comment in the press statement that he did at the State Department, saying that we're looking at the remnants of genocide, a hurried effort by the State Department spokesman to kind of get that toothpaste back in the tube the next day, and then when General Gratian was on Diane Rehm yesterday, and if any of you want to listen to that clip, it's up on our website right now, saying that he doesn't believe genocide is ongoing, that Ambassador Rice does believe it's ongoing, and that they just haven't made up their mind in the administration, and he'll do whatever is ultimately decided by the president. You know, I think it's very poor stage management. I think it demonstrates a very poor understanding of how you actually determine what constitutes genocide and what doesn't, and I think it will make it harder for the administration to galvanize an effective international response. So I think there really have been some fairly troubling developments in the last 2 weeks that call into question how effectively the special envoy is doing his job, honestly. On a positive note, and I think it's important to give the special envoy credit where credit is due, from our talks with him, from what he said publicly, I think he does get the big picture that we need to focus on the situation in all of Sudan, that we can't just look at North-South, we can't just look at Darfur, that we really have to look at the situation fairly holistically if we're going to try to solve it in a lasting way. I'm not sure he's made the leap beyond that and actually figured out what the roadmap is to an overarching solution and how to use leverage both carrots and sticks to get to that point and not just hopefully use carrots to get to that point. And I think there has been a bit of a tendency by the special envoy to get bogged down in some of the crises that Khartoum has manufactured at different points, whether it's expelling humanitarian aid groups, whether it's saying they would or would not accept arbitration for some of the disputed territory with the South. I think these are traps that the government Khartoum is very good at laying traditionally, and I would certainly hope that he can avoid falling into a cycle that we've seen in the past. So with that, I will turn it over to John Prendergast.
I really only have two things to add, because I'm much more interested in getting involved in the Q&A and discussion and strategizing that would unfold hopefully in this call, but the two things that stand out to me right now are first, you know, as John says, yes, at least the rhetoric is right coming from the administration about an all-Sudan policy, but there's still this balling back and forth between energy on a Tuesday towards Darfur and energy on a Thursday towards CPA implementation. And I don't see any evidence yet that there is a real commitment to a new, invigorated, effective peace process that might, that could potentially bring about an end to the conflict in Darfur. And I think we're still sort of propping up this Doha process, which the venue is less important than what that represents, which is not what is needed to bring the parties to any kind of agreement in Darfur. So first, I would think that our advocacy needs to step up a demand for an effective peace process in Darfur, which the U.S. would play a central role in, and instead of just doing a little bit more of everything that everybody's been doing, which has not yielded anything at all in terms of a productive result. Then the second issue hinted at by John already is the tendency of this administration to favor the carrots over the sticks in with respect to Sudan, that there are key figures within this administration who believe that for some reason that pressures have already been tried but didn't work, not understanding at all how inadequate those previous pressures from previous administrations were. And therefore, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, they think that the right way to go is to incentivize the path to peace, incentivize the path to better behavior by the Khartoum regime, and with things like normalization of relations, with things like reduction in the sanctions regime, removal of the government of Sudan from the terrorist list, et cetera, without any quid pro quo, without any demonstrable change in action or behavior by the government in Khartoum. So I think this kind of a policy, which is tantamount to appeasement, not to be too rhetorical, versus principle, is means that out of the block, the administration is tilting the wrong direction, and we're going to waste a lot of time until finally the key figures in this in Washington realize, whoops, this is not working. These guys are taking every one of our incentives and pocketing them and continuing with their policy of divide and destroy in Darfur and preparation for the same to return to that policy in the South. So those are the two issues, the need for an effective peace process and the need for significant pressures as the principal means for extracting the compromises necessary for peace and extracting the behavioral change necessary for an end to genocide and crimes against humanity in all of Sudan. So those are that's my contribution, but I'm eager to hear the questions and comments and ideas that people have.
We open it up for Q&A now?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your cell phone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your cell phone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Richard Parkin.
Yes, thank you. Richard Parkins. I'm with the American Friends of the Episcopal Church of Sudan. My question is the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and given the expectation or the hope, rather, of a comprehensive policy, a holistic policy that speaks to all of the pending issues in Sudan, how would you relate that demand to the to the implementation of the CPA. In other words, the CPA is in very fragile shape now, and the constant erosion of any trust upon the part of the South Sudanese in the CPA, suggests that it's in serious trouble. And so, how does this how does the strategy that you're proposing play out in terms of the implementation of the CPA?
John, do you want to go ahead?
Go ahead.
Well, I think we just put out a paper on CPA implementation this last week that's on our website. And
yes,
for us, one of the key things has been that the international community, I think, did a very good job in forcefully forging the CPA, really putting leverage on the parties, holding everybody's feet to the fire. They got the deal, and as so often as we see, they kind of walked away from things after the deal was signed and have let things backslide pretty significantly, in part because they abandoned the strategies that got them to the deal in the first place. That they were able to secure a deal because they were attentive, they were focused, they offered incentives, they offered some punishment for not coming along with the parade, and those tactics kind of went away. And I worry that although we had this conference on the CPA here in town, if you look at the communique that was produced, it was fairly bland. In our discussions with folks who had taken part in the conference, both sides really still seem fairly far apart on a lot of key issues and not moving toward each other. So I think what's probably most important for not just the United States, but all the international community, is to move beyond the rhetorical and actually get down into the nitty-gritty practical details of implementation, focus on what's being done and what's not being done, and actually impose some costs for failed commitments. And I think that would really begin to shift the dynamic pretty significantly.
And one footnote to that point there is that I think it is a very, very important step that the Obama administration has taken to re-own the comprehensive peace agreement, to invite the parties like they did to Washington, and devote considerable diplomatic assets to relaunching, in effect, the international dynamic in helping to support the implementation of that deal is crucial. So they got one part of it correct. And then they've now set the next meeting for next month, which is exactly the right way to go, is you have frequent, high-level, sustained meetings and processes for over-implementation. This is a crucial component and prerequisite for peace in Sudan. And the only thing I think that we have a problem with, and we're just going to keep repeating this because it's such an essential point, and because it is indicative of the ideology and direction of key actors in the administration, and that is their unwillingness to apply, lack of willingness to apply pressure when one of the parties is not implementing what they had agreed to implement. So when you take the issue of Abiy, for example, the special envoy was willing to start negotiating in Washington over the Abiy's border before the decision from The Hague, which was agreed by the parties that there would be arbitration in The Hague and they would respect the decision. He was willing to negotiate that before they actually received the decision. I mean, this is indicative of a mindset that is unwilling to hold the party's feet to the fire when they are undermining the implementation of a deal that the United States helped broker. We got to stand up for the tenets and the principles and the various conditions of this comprehensive peace agreement, and when there is one of the parties, it doesn't matter which one, undermines the implementation or obstructs it, then we have to apply significant public multilateral pressure on the party to move the process forward and do that continuously. And that is the way you get deals implemented, and that's what we need to do. And if we're going to put the kid gloves on and not call out one of the parties when they're undermining the process in a significant way, then we're going to see more intransigence, more violence in the South, more failure. So it's going to require that hard line, international, multilateral standing up for the tenets of the deal, and then when there's an obstruction of that, then we have to really, really apply some muscle to get the process back on track. Next question, John.
Our next question comes from Eric Cohen from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, John, and John, and John, and all the other Johns there. Enough has been doing a really great job recently with timely, pointed, and powerful publications. John Prendergast speaking out well on the Diane Rehm show yesterday. John Norris's piece responding to the Natsios op-eds are good examples. We need a lot more of such good pieces. We're seeing too much of the Natsios message being pushed out into the press. In addition to leaders from Enough taking the lead and getting more voices, can we get more voices in the mainstream media speaking out on Darfur? How do we harness the friendly voices such as Richard Williamson or Madeleine Albright or William Cohen to have some sort of prominent speaker surge for Darfur? We just don't have enough of the good guys pushing these points that you're making on forcing pressure. Voices who have the experience and can agree with us that this is what's needed now.
I think John and I would, and the other John as well, would agree with you. And thank you for your kind words, but I think that we all agree that we need to figure out how to amplify more voices in more ways right now and make it so that the administration feels some cost or some embarrassment or sheepishness for not entirely living up to what were pretty expansive promises and words on this on the campaign trail. We've been having some good discussions behind the scenes about how we could amplify our messages more effectively, get some more voices out there, get those voices in some places where they'll be heard. And I think for us, one of the challenges is that there's probably a fair amount of folks in the administration who handle these issues who are, you know, I think fairly supportive of our cause and fairly supportive of Sudan. I think the real challenge for all of us is to battle our way onto the radar screens of some of those key political decision makers in the administration who don't necessarily follow Africa policy, who don't necessarily follow Sudan, but who are fairly powerful in determining the president's agenda from day to day, how he uses the bully pulpit, and how much he wades into. And, you know, we understand that it's a very crowded both international and domestic plate for the president right now, but Sudan is an issue he's spoken out on quite forcefully in the past, and we want to make sure that there's enough pressure exerted on the bureaucracy that he's able to follow through with those commitments. John, anything you would add to that?
Yeah, and I think we will, as a part of this dialogue that we're engaged in now, make a much more concerted effort to try to get those voices, as you're suggesting, those kind of names, to weigh in structured ways, whether they're op-eds, whether they're television appearances, whether they're even blogs. You know, we just find ways to get their voices out there and put them into the mix so that there is a you know, we can start to build some momentum again. I think there was just, this is the way it is when the first 6 months of a new administration, Republican or Democrat, a lot of people, you don't want to start from, January 22nd, start attacking, because there really is a lag time that is required to give an organization as complex as the United States government time to really get its act together on any issue. But I think that time is now past. I think our willingness to intensify our our decibel level in defense of or in support of a more robust agenda with respect to Sudan is going to increase fairly rapidly. And so finding the right people to be in the chorus and getting them to agree to do it, because a lot of people want to keep, you know, a lower profile for now. But we'll keep trying to encourage and urge people to speak out on principle about the issues related to peace in Sudan. Next issue.
Our next question comes from Michael Rosero from Richmond, Virginia.
Yes, I. My question is about what we can do locally to be able to support this. I have an organization that's got about 400 people on a newsletter mailing list, and you know, we want to be able to organize events during the summer months when people are out more, and to be able to encourage action. And I would like to know what is the best way to support this with the implementation of the CPA and a Total Sudan strategy. What's the best way to organize that locally?
I would imagine John Bagwell, you also have some thoughts and should be encouraged to wade in here as well. But, you know, I think the summer months really are an important time for activists at a local level, in that you've got representatives spending more time in their district and less time in Washington. Not that being here 90 degrees and 90% humidity isn't ideal. But, you know, that's a good time to have some kind of show of force so that your local representatives can see that this issue should be on their radar, encourage them to call senior figures in the administration and ask them where the Sudan policy review is, express concerns about some of the very mixed signals that have been coming out of the different parts of the Sudan policy-making machinery in the last couple weeks. Encourage local media to continue to cover the issue and try to get it kind of back on the front burner again, because part of the problem for us all is that it's the media has a very short attention span. But John Bagwell, any other thoughts on your side?
No, I think that that's a good summary. I will say that if you're speaking specifically based on any problems that you've had, summer is traditionally, of course, the hardest time to really mobilize people in a big way, because students are out of school, they're not in their normal communities that are able to be mobilized, and people taking longer vacations and everything. But there are certainly plenty of opportunities, as John Norris pointed out there, to organize locally. And you don't need big numbers. What you need is a consistent presence, and then you need some sharp punches occasionally, you know, with a larger event, with some stronger press, to really get the attention of the elected officials. And that's really what we're battling for here. Is our issue is interesting because we're not battling against many people who disagree with us that the situation in Sudan is bad and something needs to be done about it. What we're battling is to get it and keep it high enough up on the radar so that more substantial action is taken. And I think that there are a variety of ways that you can consistently do that on a local level that John talked about there, through media, making sure that your representative is representing your thoughts and opinions on the subject, and that it's high enough up on his or her priority list as they're representing you in Congress are very important things.
And then, and obviously, man, it takes nothing to add this, any knowledge of the world to figure this one out. Is you live in a swing state that matters a lot to Obama. You've seen his pattern of travel already. He's already campaigning for 2012. You've got two up-and-coming Democratic senators in Webb and Warner who have already distinguished themselves and have some influence. Go see them, or go see their chiefs of staff and hit them, you know, on a weekly or biweekly basis with a subgroup of your 400-person list. And ask them separately to get in touch directly with the president and ask him to do all that he can to bring peace to Sudan. Basically, we're looking for an increase in temperature. The more that President Obama feels that key Democratic senators are unhappy with the level of engagement and intensity on the Sudan portfolio, the more he will ask questions about what is going on, and he will insert himself into the process. Rahm Emanuel will insert himself into the process. We need to politicize this issue, and you politicize it through, in my view, the Senate Democrats, and you get them asking questions of the president, why aren't you doing more, why are we seeing no results in Darfur, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There will be other things to do, lots of other gimmicks and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, we're looking for an increase in temperature, and the most rapid increase I think you can achieve is through the Democrats in the Senate and the leadership and the Democrats in the House. If they're agitating for more action or they're unhappy with the lack of results or the lack of progress or all this rhetoric that's coming out of this envoy that is undermining a cohesive, clear American message on Darfur and on Sudan, then he does not want to mess with politics. He does not want to make this, he doesn't want to turn this political plus for him, because it has been a political plus for him, because he was a very strong senator on Darfur, into a political liability. And he will move to address that. That is the thing that's going to affect the calculation of President Obama, is politics. So let's do it. Let's get these senators through your group there in Richmond, going to visit his chief of staff, going to visit Webb's or Warner's key legislative assistants down there, and then go try to get a meeting with them while they're at home in the summer, like my colleagues have said, and tell them why aren't they going to be champions on this issue, and if you want to be a champion, here's what we want you to do, and you give them jobs to do, and then have them, and then tell them you're going to call in a week or two to find out what the result of what he said he pledges he was going to do. What results came out of it.
Your next question comes from Corey Williams from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm glad Eric Cullen was on the phone, because my question actually refers to some work he's getting ready to do. On July 2nd, Vanguard is going to hold their shareholders meeting in Phoenix, Arizona, and Eric and Investors Against Genocide have been working hard to get a group together to attend that shareholders meeting. Well, now with General Gratian's article that came out from the Post, I think their job has been made much harder, because they can just point right to General Gratian's direct comments and say the government isn't involved. Why should we divest? You know, why should we even talk to you or listen to you? Because the President Obama's administration is saying the government isn't involved and the genocide is almost over. So how would you address those questions if they came at you from shareholders you were trying to work with to get them to divest from Sudan?
Well, I think even if we were to take Gratian's comments, read them the worst way, I mean, he still is saying that he feels that a genocide did occur. I mean, for there to be remnants of a genocide, I'm assuming that there would have to have been genocide. It is still a country whose president is wanted for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and if the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is believed, potentially facing a genocide charge over next couple weeks or next couple months. So I think there clearly are profound human rights abuses that have occurred. I think you can say that every investor deserves to know that their money is not tied up in these kind of atrocities. And that's something that every company, as a matter of due diligence, should follow up on. So I don't think it should be spun as somehow that the U.S. government is getting out of the business of dealing with Sudan, or that the responsibility of individual investors or individual companies is any way lessened.
I didn't understand what Gratian was talking about, and my feeling was that he didn't understand what he was talking about. And I think that, you know, it's just indicative of a shoot-from-the-hip diplomacy that is extremely unhelpful and takes the wind out of the sails, potentially, or is designed to take the wind out of the sails, if we let it, of activist efforts. Don't let it. It's a silly comment. It has nothing to do with reality. Darfur continues to deteriorate. Companies are engaged in Sudan and doing business with Sudan, and the divestment movement must continue to expand, just as the anti-apartheid movement didn't stop every time there was some little incremental reform made by the apartheid South African government back in the 80s. You keep the pressure on until there is a change. And when there's a change, when there's peace in Darfur, then we can stop the divestment campaign. But until then, I say press the foot to the accelerator and blow right through these idiotic statements we're getting from officials in Washington.
Thank you, guys. That helps a lot.
Your last question comes from Ahmed Kaduda from Washington, D.C.
Yes, hello. My name is Ahmed Kaduda. I'm with the Committee on Conscience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. I have two questions. First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Prendergast. I was at your Congo talk today. It was very insightful and helpful. But if you allow me, regarding the first, my first question is regarding the genocide issue. And when you say that we haven't seen any change on the ground, you know, I'd like to respectfully disagree because there has been, you know, a substantial drop in the amount of death rates, and according to the UN and NGOs, there's been more deaths in the south than in Darfur due to violence. So if there's a tangible change on the ground just by the numbers, why is enough so strongly push integration? Or as you put it, raise the temperature? Because after all, you know, genocides do slow down and eventually stop and end, and could the end have already happened, or are we seeing the end of the violence that we've seen in 2004? And my second question is, should we, I know there's a lot of talking about how to continue to push the administration, but should we allow perhaps some room for change in strategy in the administration and allow them, for example, to engage with the Doha process? Because I don't recall reading much about enough position on the peace process that's been taking place in Doha between, for example, GEM and the government of Sudan, and the current envoy and the administration have been the strongest proponents of that, and that's hopefully the way forward out of the Darfur issue. So what do you think about that?
John, if I could handle
this. Johnny, he's talking about what I'm talking about here. Listen.
Sure.
Read the Genocide Convention. I'm increasingly fed up with our activist movement not doing its homework. Read the convention. The convention says actions designed to bring about conditions leading to the destruction in whole or in part of particular groups of people. There are all kinds of strategies that go into the commission of genocide. It's not just the village burnings and the attack helicopters of 2003 and 2005. It also is the policy of the use of systematic rape by the military and paramilitary forces that have been paid for, armed, and organized by the government of Sudan. It's also a policy of arming and continuing to support ethnic militias, which keep people warehoused in these camps and too afraid to go home because of the insecurity. And it's also turning on and off the humanitarian assistance tap. There is too much publicity focused now since the Darfur movement erupted on what the Sudanese government is doing in Darfur for them to go in and start slaughtering people like they did between 2003 and 2005. But we saw the same kind of ebb and flow in the government of Sudan's behavior in southern Sudan, where when the temperature got too hot for them, they stopped doing whatever they were doing for a while, the slave raiding, the use of food as a weapon of war, all the strategies that brought about the deaths of 2.25 million people. And this is just what they're doing. They're continuing a policy. I didn't say that conditions are the same as they were in 2003 and 2005. I said they are deteriorating. In other words, people are in the situation that they're in because of what happened between 2003 and 2005, and their situation is deteriorating because of the actions of the government in restricting humanitarian assistance. General Gration is incorrect. Ask any humanitarian assistance program officer from any humanitarian assistance organization to say that the assistance has been brought back to where it was. And by the way, when was the status quo ante of March or whenever the Sudanese government threw those NGOs out acceptable for human beings to live under? This is a policy of genocide by attrition, as Eric Reeves calls it, and I believe very, very strongly. I would not get hung up on spending a lot of time debating it, because we've got to focus our effort and attention on what to do about it. But the reason why I spend a little time, and I'm so excited about it right now, is because it is indicative of a mindset. When Gratian says it is not, or isn't genocide anymore, he's basically saying, so what's the big problem? Let's focus on a few things. Let's take the activists out of the equation. Let's take the temperature down a few notches, so we can pursue a policy of constructive engagement, incentive-based constructive engagement with the Sudanese government, and make some kind of deal so we can cut the losses on this thing and move on. And I don't agree with that approach. I think people need to be held accountable when they commit genocide. I think we need to support the International Criminal Court in its ongoing investigations and its efforts to bring to bear justice on for the people of Darfur. And I think we need to work assiduously on ensuring that the mentality of the Obama administration remains one of confrontation with people who are willing to treat people the way they have. This government has been willing to treat its own citizens in Darfur and for what it's gearing up to do in southern Sudan, because we are going to see the next iteration of southern Sudan's war if we do not challenge the government of Sudan now, the ruling party in Sudan, in its lack of implementation of the CPA and its willingness to obstruct the referendum in 18 months. So that is why it matters so much. First, it matters to read the convention and understand what it says. Now, good people can disagree. If after you've read the convention and you say, okay, well, I've read it and I don't think we have enough proof of the intention of the government of Sudan to destroy in whole or in part particular groups of people, I respect that position. But I'll tell you right now, as John Norris hinted, the International Criminal Court is taking new evidence on this question of genocide. They were split 2-1. One judge thought there was enough evidence about genocide. Two of them thought there wasn't yet. They've submitted new evidence. They are reviewing that evidence, and the rumor is that they are going to reissue additional arrest accounts on the arrest warrant for genocide. In other words, good people can disagree. People who are motivated by the same objective of bringing an end to this conflict can disagree. So the idea that somehow, because conditions are better, because they aren't burning villages every day in Darfur, that it isn't genocide, I think that indicates it's just the wrong, you're arguing the wrong point. If we can have a discussion about what the convention is and what genocide definition, what is required to occur on the ground for genocide to pertain, that's another debate. But I believe the use of ethnic militias, the rape as a tool of war, an instrument of social control, and the turning on and off of assistance to devastate communities, to demoralize communities, and ultimately to break their back, their spirit, I believe this constitutes genocidal intent. And it isn't as dramatic as 2003 and 2005, but it requires an equally vigorous response from the United States on principle.
And just to fill in a little bit extra there, and to certainly endorse John's remarks, you know, both John and the questioner identify the fact that the tactics that the government are using have indeed changed and evolved over time. But there are some things that have not changed, that we still have hundreds of thousands of people dead. We still have no one who's been held accountable or brought to justice for those killings. And we still have millions of people who cannot return home, either displaced in Darfur or refugees in Chad. So if you want to look at a barometer of the relative success or failure of international policy towards Sudan, can people go home? Do they have security to carry out the basic functions of life? Do they have the ability to generate an income, to do all the things that we take for granted? No. The answer was no in 2003, it was no in 2004, and it's no right now. So some of the fundamentals of the situation have not changed at all. even though the tactics pursued by the government in trying to crush their opponents have. In terms of the Doha process, you know, I think it is a good process for the United States to engage with, but I don't think that there's a lot of people with a lot of conviction that the Doha process will actually produce a lasting deal. You know, I think it's a nice place for people to get together and have conversations, but it does not have the hallmarks of effective, decisive diplomacy with a full buy-in from the international community. You know, and I think from our discussions with diplomats from other countries, from the UN, from elsewhere, there's a real thirst for the United States to lead a process right now. And people are really looking towards Washington very expectantly, and I'm not sure at this point that their expectations have been fulfilled.
If you allow me to just say one thing, I think that Gratian's engagement has actually led to the bringing back of at least three international NGOs, and not only that, John Holmes last week actually said that capacity is actually back to 100%. And I'm not trying to defend the Sudan government, believe me. I'm just trying to see how we can actually work with this administration, because it's very difficult to work against it. We can work with it because if we see that Gratian on the ground has actually been able to bring back these three NGOs and capacity, according to John Holmes, the UN humanitarian chief, said that capacity is back at 100, why are we so vehemently standing against that?
John Holmes said with all of the groups using all of their emergency capacity, gaps were being filled close to what they were before, but obviously it's not sustainable. And, you know, and this is a great example of the pitfalls to fall in, that are we supposed to give the government of Sudan a nice little present, a nice little reward for kicking out 13 life-saving organizations, including some who are carrying out work in southern Sudan, really vital to the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and then reward them for allowing three groups to return with numerous restrictions and after some nonsensical rebranding exercise where they're suddenly operating as NGO Sweden. No, it's ridiculous. You know, and to think that this is a sign of goodwill from Khartoum or effective diplomatic handling by the international community, no. It's a manufactured crisis by Khartoum, as we learned brutally over the long course of the now North-South War. The government is more than willing to use food as a weapon of war and will turn on and off the taps of humanitarian assistance to further their political goals, no matter what the human cost. And it would be an absolute tragedy if the international community allows that to continue and allows that strategy to again be used effectively by the government in Darfur.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Jacob Kumar from Greenbrook, New Jersey.
Yes. What has changed on the ground? I know the comments by Gratian would imply that something has changed. What has changed about the situation in recent years? Has anything?
Oh, sure. I think, you know, as John said in his comments, that clearly we're not seeing widespread aerial attacks. We've seen various evolution splits, reemergence in rebel groups. We've seen Chad trying to arm itself against possible Sudanese-backed incursions. You know, a lot has changed on the ground over time. You know, NGOs have gotten to the point where they're extremely frustrated and at the limits of being able to operate and feel that there are too many restrictions in place. We've seen what was an ineffective African Union force merge into a fairly ineffective African Union United Nations force. There's been lots of changes and lots of developments on the ground, and we're not denying that fact. But I think it is important to not get lost in the hubbub of the day-to-day and take a step back and look at what we would argue are some very deliberate and some very well seasoned and well-tried tactics by the government of Sudan to stoke local tensions, to use proxy militias, to direct and conduct gross human rights violations and abuses on the ground, to ease up a little bit when they face more international resolve, and then to resume as soon as the tension turns away.
Your next question comes from Justin Lickew from Canada.
I have a couple of suggestions here, and maybe one question or two. One suggestion I would like to make to everybody who is concerned about Darfur and southern Sudan, and maybe also we can include the eastern Sudan, that we need to kind of see it's important to have Darfur conference, try to bring all of Darfur together and listen to them and see what they have in mind. It's important. Because what is happening now, most of the people of Darfur have been excluded. Only the military factions are the ones doing those negotiations. And if you see the Doha conference is only, I don't think it's going to be positive in the near future, because Doha itself as a host is not neutral. It's always started by the government of the Sudan, by the regime of Khartoum. So we have to be mindful of that. I think it is important to give some attention to Darfur conference. Maybe could be organized by the U.S. or any other country, donor countries, and so on. In the earlier, some of you have mentioned that how can we make an effective peace process to move forward. I think this is one of the things that we need to bear in mind for the effective peace to take place. You have to have this dialogue of how to bring everybody together from the grassroots. And this takes me to the SPLA and the government of Southern Sudan. Why the CPA is now in trouble, because the fact that also we need to put a pressure not only on the government of Khartoum, the regime in Khartoum, but also we need to be also mindful that the SPLA, the government in southern Sudan, it is not representing everybody. So there is a need for to be put to the pressure of the government of southern Sudan under the leadership of Salva Kiir, because if you look today, the Salva Kiir government is only represented by one group, the group of Denka. The other one in the ministries, foreign services, everywhere. Southern Sudan has more than 65 groups, tribes, all excluded from, maybe in marginal way. And therefore, this not to have everybody not represented in the government of Southern Sudan, it gives a chance to the Khartoum government to use people who have been marginalized, say, look, the government of Southern Sudan is not representing everybody, it is only on a tribal basis. Therefore, you form your own party, and I will support you. And we have seen recently with what happened with Dr. Lam McCall. And I think it's important that a group like you and everybody, we have to kind of, has to stress this issue that the government of Southern Sudan has to be holistically representing everybody from the Southern Sudan, not because on a tribal basis, or not, but the merit or the competence of the job. The other thing to do, the last question I think I have to do with the generalist comments. I think you're absolutely right. We need to make sure that the general should not make such a statement, because it gives Khartoum a chance to get away from with all the crimes. Because if Ambassador Rice is saying that there is a genocide, Obama through his campaign the whole last year and so on talks about there's a genocide going on in Sudan, and yet came a new envoy is saying there's no genocide. I think it is kind of giving a conflicting comments. I think it's not going to help us, but it will help the government of Khartoum. It's going to help the oppressor more than the victims. So I think we need to kind of put a pressure on the government of Obama. I think the pressure should actually continue on, so that at least the victims in Darfur should get their justice, and somebody should get away with that. And finally, regarding the NGO that was brought back into the Sudan, I think we, as some of you had mentioned, and I've seen it myself, I was in Sudan recently, and I'll be going back in a couple of weeks from now, they were brought under different conditions. They are not; they cannot do what they're supposed to be doing freely or whatever and all things. So we have to be mindful. Not allowing the NGOs is something else, but the condition under which they're going to work is a different story, and this is what we're supposed to be looking at. And thank you.
Thanks. I think those were very constructive comments, and I think John and I would agree with most of those that were very supportive of the idea of more actively engaging Darfuri civil society in the peace process, And we think that one of the key reasons that the Darfur peace agreement didn't work was because there wasn't the buy-in from a broader community. And obviously trying to figure out how to have more voices heard in a peace process is often a recipe for making sure that they actually hold up over time. I think that probably brings us just about to an hour. John, should we squeeze in one more?
Let's go for it.
All right.
Your next question comes from Carmen Carlesio from New Rochelle, New York.
Hi, everyone. I almost don't know where to begin. I have so many questions and comments, but I'll try to keep my focus. Actually, what the gentleman was just talking about regarding civil society, isn't there some way that we could try to facilitate a rescheduling of that conference that was canceled in Ethiopia? If not in Ethiopia, then somewhere else. Because, again, that was a perfect example of the Khartoum government, you know, stopping any kind of positive participation by the people who they're trying to kill off in this genocide. That's one question. I've had a little back and forth with John Prendergast on the Gratian thing. I mean, shouldn't we be trying to get this guy out? He is the face of the administration, and the things he has said have been so damaging. I mean, we don't need to be fighting the very person who's representing the administration, and that's the situation that he's put us in. Or if we can't get rid of him, I remember when we met with Ambassador Rice in New York, we were told that there was going to be a team. Where is the team? Maybe he can continue to do the conferences, you know, on the CPA, but aren't we going to have other players in the administration who are going to be part of this diplomatic team?
Well, certainly on the idea of rescheduling the conference, we fully support that and have been working with some folks, including our own Omar Ismail, to hopefully make that happen, and we'll continue to see that as a very important thing to help carry off. You know, does Gratian go or stay? I think it is important that the administration hear how frustrated, annoyed, and outraged people are by his comments and make that clear. And hopefully that leads the administration to, take a look at how it is producing Sudan policy. I think it's very frustrating from our perspective. The promised Sudan policy review is still working its way through the system, and it's clear that they're still debating these issues out in a way that's not very productive if presented publicly. So clearly they need, I think, some pressure to treat this as a real imperative, because I think the higher it moves up the food chain in the administration, the more competent the hands are that are dealing with it, and the more likely that they're to get it right and avoid some of the simple mistakes that we've seen from the special envoy in the last 2 weeks.
And can I add one more thing? I haven't seen anything in the media about that attack on the girls at the University of Khartoum. I mean, that's another example of a continuation of this genocide. That's a deliberate attempt to, you know, hurt these young girls who were gathering together in their dorm room to discuss the fate of their relatives in Darfur. And yet I just checked the Times. There's nothing in the Times. There's nothing anywhere about it in the mainstream media.
No, that's a good point. And mainstream media seems to kind of wander on from crisis du jour to crisis du jour, and we need all your help and our own efforts to try to keep them on focus. So on behalf of the Troika of Johns, I just want to thank everybody for joining us today. I know that we could probably continue with another hour of questions easily, but I just can't tell you how appreciative we are of all the hard work and all the commitment from the folks that are on the phone right now. You guys do terrific work. We know it's not easy, and we know it is sometimes frustrating, and we share some of those frustrations, but I think we'll get there. And so thanks, and we will stay in steady touch.
Thank you.